With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
Welcome back, listeners, to RCR Greenwashed with Jasper and Don. And I hope you've had a good Monday to date and build into a better week. And as we're going to do by talking to the gentleman we have on, we have Craig Kelly back. He was on our show a year or so ago, or last May, actually. And of course, Craig's been in the news again this week with his move to the One Nation Party. I would say, Craig, you're acting like a kangaroo. You're jumping all over the place. But welcome back to the show, and we will. Look, let's hook into it. You've had quite a career in politics. You're trying to find your way back into it. And it's not easy, is it, when you've got the media playing a big game against you? I've read lots about you. What's keeping Craig Kelly motivated? Because, you know, I think you've got something similar to here where effectively we think we've got a conservative sort of side of yes. Parliament, and they're not.
Okay, well, I originally joined the Liberal Party. There was a Conservative Party under Tony Abbott. So we marched in the streets against the carbon tax. The Liberal Party was meant to be the party of freedom and individual rights and small government. That's the Liberal Party that I joined. And in the 12 years I was a member of Parliament, or 11 years before I changed, I saw all those values slip away. In fact, where we went from marching in the streets against the carbon tax to being cheering on net zero. So the Liberal Party has had a major transformation and stepped a long way to the left side of politics, where I felt during COVID, the restrictions that they were putting on, the trampling of human rights, forcing people to undergo mandatory medical interventions, the violation of the doctor-patient relationship, that sanctity of the doctor-patient relationship, the big government approach to everything, it was no longer the Liberal Party that I joined and believed in. So I resigned. I firstly became an independent, and I was happy to fight in that parliament as independent for the values that I believed in, and wrote the next election as independent. And, that one person, one voice in parliament often doesn't give you the opportunity to make much of a difference. So the opportunity that came up with what was called the United Australia Party, which was backed by Mr. Clive Palmer. So we had the finances to actually run a really strong campaign. And even though we weren't successful electorally, we had one senator elected. Before the election campaign, we ran very strong advertisements on freedom, freedom, freedom. We had giant billboards across the country everywhere with this freedom, freedom, freedom logo that we ran. We ran a very active campaign in the media against the vaccine mandates. And a lot of those things, by the time we got to the election campaign, a lot of those more draconian measures had all been wound back. So a lot of the things that we were fighting on in the lead-up to the election campaign all sort of fell away. So we had a bit of a disappointing result, I have to admit, but we did get one senator elected. Looking beyond that, it was clear to me one of the strongest of the minor parties, and our electoral system is a little bit different to your electoral system over there for the minor parties. Federally, it's very hard for a minor party to win one of the lower house seats. And in the upper house, we elect six senators every election in each state. And you really, a quota is about 14%. So you need 14% to get a senator elected. But you can get up on about 7 or 8 or 9%. So you need that 7, 8, 9, 10% of the vote to be able to get elected into that federal parliament. And always I think in your system, you can get people elected on a bit lower. So the reality was that the United Australia Party was behind, well behind, One Nation in the polling. The policies of the party are almost identical. During the last election campaign, everywhere we went with the United Australia Party, there were One Nation people, and they were our friends. We'd drink together, we'd have dinner together, we'd talk together. Our people would share resources. We were effectively united at the hip, sort of thing. So the opportunity's come up with the One Nation Party to be the national director running into the next election campaign. Well, I have the job of getting a team in shape in all. I've got 151 lower houses in all the states and territories. And that's my job, to put a team together on the ground to contest that election and to give us our best chance. I think there's a couple of lower house seats that we really have a chance in, but to make sure that we could get one representative in each state into that next Australian Senate and then have a chance of having the balance of power and really making a difference to where the direction this country's headed.
Yeah, look, fantastic. It's interesting you talk about how the Liberal Party sort of deserted you, because I've got on my filing cabinet behind me a photo of 2003 fight against ridiculous taxes was the concept, where I was one of the leaders. And we had pretty much all the National Party leadership on the front line there. And by 2008, 9, 10, they deserted me. You know, so supposedly the Conservative Party had deserted me, and that they have signed into net zero, just like your Liberal Party. So
that's what amazes me over there. Like, your economy is so, relying upon your strong agricultural sector and your strong dairy sector. And under net zero, your dairy sector doesn't exist. Like, talk about taking a gun to head and blowing your brains out. And yet what the so-called Conservative Party over there has signed up to this stuff.
Completely unbelievable.
At the meantime, we argue here in Australia, our great advantage is coal. We have just some rough numbers to put in perspective against China, right? We have 21 gigawatts of coal-fired power stations left, right? China has 1,100. So they have 50 times more active coal-fired power stations than what we do. That's today, right? And where we're closing down that 21, China have under active construction today another 136 gigawatts of electricity, coal-fired generation. So that's six times what we've got, which we're closing down over the next 10, 15, 20 years, China are building today. And they've got another, additionally, on top of that, they've got another 255 gigawatts in pre-construction, which is 10 times our total coal fleet. And we're closing it down and thinking we're going to make a difference. Yeah, it is beyond absurdity. And the real concern with this policy is everything to do with this net zero, it hands an economic, political, and military advantage to the communist Chinese. It weakens Australia. It is a wealth transfer from this nation. I think it's the same in New Zealand. It is a wealth transfer from our nations to the communist Chinese. And how we've got politicians in both Australia and New Zealand that are just going along with that because it's popular and not standing up and looking at the long-term consequences of what this is going to have, I think is a disgrace. And it's no surprise to me today that we've had the ASIO, the boss of that's Australia's National Security Agency, come out and say there's spies in the political party. Spies influenced by communist China that are traitors to this nation, that have sold this nation out and are working for the Chinese communists.
I mean, you look at universities, most of them seem to have Confucius Institutes. It is open out there. And talking of no opposition, we have our Liberal Party, ACT, which was supposed to stand up for all of this. They say, they're all for net zero, but they're going to give us technologies to mitigate our emissions. So it is like, more than one way to skin a cat. And New Zealand, I don't know, you guys, you still have an Australia. You have a good half a dozen senators who will speak up. We have nobody, Craig. The silence is deafening.
Yeah. Look, I understand. I think there was a smaller party there that won a few people at the last election. They seem to have been very quiet since they got elected. It sometimes happens that people make a bit of noise in opposition. When they get to the federal parliament, it's like, I don't say anything. I can't say anything because the media might attack me. And we've got to get away from this thing. If the media's, as a politician, my rule was, if the media's not attacking you and there's not people out there having a go at you and making horrible cartoons of you and really getting stuck into you, you're not doing your job. That's the best indication, right? If everything's good and there's no criticism of you, you're not doing your job and you want to get off your backside and start working.
Well, in fact, you're a good witness
example
to that.
I,
yeah, exactly, because you look at your Wikipedia page and, man, they give you a hard time. And I think it's a badge of honour, Craig. I'm like you. If they they're finding something to criticize at you, that you're doing your job. And it's a pity that more people wouldn't stand tall on principle and defend their argument and be given the chance. But no, mainstream media has a very good way of trying to humiliate and shut you down. So, yeah, look, it's interesting, though. We've had a lot of similarities and a lot of things different and as well, to be honest. But we've got a coalition over here now. So there's the three supposed right-of-centre parties, if you can find them in New Zealand. They're supposedly right-of-centre, all joined at the hip through this agreement. How long that will last will be the test. At the moment, it seems to be going swimmingly. But as you said, people go a bit quiet when those coalition agreements are first formed, and you sort of wait for one person to sort of blot their copybook. So look, we'll see how it plays out. You've had so many changes, though, in Australian politics. For instance, there seems to be quite, and it's happened here too, especially in the Labor Party. The rats are leaving the ship, so to speak. And you've had quite a few leave the Liberal Party. You had a Minister of Health, I think, Greg Hunt. Where's he vanished to? Because he was
retired. He's gone into retirement. He was on, I think, the old pension scheme. So we had an old parliamentary pension scheme. If you're elected before 2004, when you retired, you basically received half of the highest salary you had tax-free for life. So that's a very I missed out on that. Look, and there is, I know it does seem over the top of what it was, but one thing, it was being rorted before, people were double dipping. They're going, getting a job in the private sector and picking up a parliamentary pension. I think there's a good argument for some type of parliamentary pension. Now, I know it's not going to make me very popular, but you've got to have people who can go into that parliament and speak without fear or favour, and not have to worry about, well, you know, I've got to suck up to this big company because, you know, I could be out of a position here. You know, my seat could be redistributed. Something could happen. There could be some scandal that's outside of my control. I could be out of parliament at any time. Mm-hmm. And where am I going to go get a job? The best place is one of the big companies that I was giving all these favours to.
Yeah.
So you've got to make sure that doesn't happen. You've got to have politicians in
looking
there.
Looking at Greg Hunt's page, Craig, his website, greghunt.com.au, he says he's retired. Thank you for the privilege, Flinders. And I've been appointed Honorary Melbourne Enterprise Professor by the University of Melbourne and the chair of the Monash University Turner Institute, which incidentally deals with, he's going to be on our advisory panel for this institute that deals in brain and mental health. That's a good place, isn't it? He's wrecked the mental health of many suits. That's just, I couldn't think of something more fitting. No.
Interesting. Monash University is the place that we're still waiting for the release of their ivermectin study. same as we have with Oxford in the US. They ran these, especially Oxford in the UK, ran this very large ivermectin trial. Yes, they had all the release results are going to be out soon. It's been over one year and they are still hiding the results. We know Monash ran an ivermectin trial and the results have sort of disappeared as well there, sort of thing. You know, they haven't published any results. And Monash was also the place where the government did a joint venture deal with Moderna to make the mRNA vaccines in Australia. So it's not surprising that a few of the old politicians end up something to do with it, Monash University, since the number of government money that flows towards them.
Gosh, it's incredible. We've got a similar thing happening right now, but not on the same scale, perhaps. But we've got a former finance minister who's gone to be a vice chancellor of a university. And you'd have to say he didn't leave the books of this country in a very good state. So I can't see how he's going to resurrect a university. But there you go.
A lot of these politicians that I've had the experience of being in Canberra with, you wouldn't let them run the school tuck shop. You wouldn't let them run a cake store, a church cake stall sort of thing. It's for their level of competence. And yet they appear in these sort of bureaucratic job where they just sort of tick and flick stuff. And, this is why I think, you know, our nations are heading in the wrong direction. I know we've had some numbers out a week ago. The decline in Australia, our real gross incomes, so your expendable incomes, declined faster than any other OECD nation in the world, over the last 12 months. We're going backwards at 100 miles an hour, and it's only getting worse with the policies that Albanese is putting in, and the Liberals are offering no real alternative.
Gosh, I would have thought New Zealand would have been right with you, because we've had inflation, I think headline inflation 7.2 or something percent, yeah. But the non-tradables, the government and local government expansion is unbelievable. There's no reining that stuff in yet for some reason.
Well, it's all these unproductive jobs that have been created.
Yes.
This is what it is, all these government jobs. You know, it's sort of like I'm moving, you know, sort of one piece of paper from here to there, to backwards and forwards, and they're not actually achieving any real wealth. Which compared to your farming community out there, every day they're out there creating wealth in the country. And that's what pays all the bills. Shuffling paper from one side of the desk to the other doesn't pay the bills. At the end of the day, someone's got to make something, mine something, grow something, farm something, right? That's where you create the wealth in society. And all the government spending is directed at this bigger and bigger bureaucracy, which is sort of like being financed on this smaller and smaller, so wealth creators of the nation.
I know your Bureau of Statistics found that an extra 270,000 government workers than expected. You are currently at 2.43 million government employees, bureaucrats last year, June. And I wonder how many of those, Craig, were created during the voice referendum? How many people were busy
The expenditure, they said, was between $450 million Australian and $500 million Australian.
Wow.
So that's what we spent on a referendum, which was unnecessary to start with, right? The Prime Minister, if he wanted to have some separate advisory body of Indigenous Australians, he could have just set it up. He didn't need to have a referendum, right? So he could have set it up. So the whole thing was unnecessary to start with, but mainly it was divisive. It really divided. It divided the nation, and those divisions are taking a time to heal. Because I opposed this referendum. And I thought, oh, I'm going to hide into nothing here. There's no way in the world this can be beaten. It's so politically correct. And everyone, yes, we must vote. Yes, we must show our respect to our Indigenous brothers, But it came out, we had a lot of Indigenous Australians actually opposing when they saw the detail. And I was. This is one thing that gives me a lot of hope for the future. The way those polls turned around here in Australia. Now, when the idea first came out, it was like almost 70% for and 30% against. That's how it was first. And day by day, those polls. The more people knew about it, the more open and transparent debate that we had. The more people said, "Hang on a minute, this is a bad idea." And at the end of the day, it was a landslide to the no. It was like a 60% against it, only 40% for. So the idea that you can, it just shows if you're prepared to fight your argument, if you're prepared to get out there and not be intimidated by them, because all the media and every big woke corporation in the country was all for this. You saw Qantas Airlines painting their planes with the YES logo on them, and the big supermarkets, the Woolworths supermarkets, everyone had YES up on all their through all their stores. So you had all of this, but because we're able to get in there, argue the case rationally, put the arguments towards people, we were able to move the dial. And that gives me great confidence for the future that where we see these absurd policies, these absurd destructive policies like net zero, and these absurd destructive policies like these ridiculous levels of extreme high rates of migration that we're having, that we can put the case to the Australian people, we can argue the case, we can argue it logically with facts and data and reason, and we can change people's opinion.
So, come Monday after that voice referendum result, it did strike me that there was a lot of poor losers in Australia, because the media sort of went back on the attack and they were giving Linda Burney and others a lot of airtime saying, we might have lost, but we haven't lost the war sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And it looks like it's back on their agenda. So it's going to take a lot to hold the line on this, I think, Craig.
A lot of people have with it. But the bottom line is that we didn't want in our Australian Constitution a provision that divided us by race. That was the simple concept that the society that I think we should have is that doesn't matter what the color of your skin is, what your background is, what your religion is, what race you're from, right? If you get in and you work hard, you can achieve what you want to achieve in this country. That's the type of country that we should have. But there's a lot of people that say, no, we've got to divide us all. You know, divide us all by race, and let's have a special part for the Indigenous Australians. And where a lot of Australians saw through this was a lot of people claiming to be Indigenous. Like when you looked at their family tree, they were 132nd. Right? Yep. They might have had like one great grandmother that was an Indigenous Australian, and everyone else had British heritage in their family tree. But they were claiming the Indigenous rights to special low costs, everything, special subsidies here, and special this sort of thing, which was really people look at that and go, hang on a minute, this is not a fair go.
No, it is not. Yeah. Perhaps this is a good time to take a break. You are on Greenwashed, and we're speaking to Craig Kelly over from Australia. And we'll come back and talk more about immigration, something, Craig, we discussed a lot the previous time around, and get into a bit more detail about this. But for now, Don, can you lead us into a break?
Well, yeah, I think we should play a bit of Fred Dagg, a bit of humour, keep this thing light for a bit, and at least a couple of minutes, a bit of... Perhaps it will be Australian New Zealand banter from Fred Dagg. He was a really good raconteur. Sad he's gone, but I'm sure Craig's heard him before as well. So look, we'll be back after the break.
Welcome back to Greenwash here with Jaspreet and Don, and we have here from the Lucky Country, Craig Kelly joining us. And Craig, before we went on to the break, we said we'll speak about immigration and how that's impacted Australia as you've seen it. Now, I was in Melbourne recently, a couple of months ago, and so late 2023, and I was last in Melbourne 2014. So in a period of 9 years, driving through Melbourne this time around, it felt like a completely different place. And I came home and looked up statistics. So in those less than a decade, it went up from 4.2 million people to 5.3 million people. That's phenomenal, 25% increase. Sydney has got similar numbers, similar rise in population, and much of it fueled by immigration. You have your Institute of Public Affairs that has come out saying that record migration is worsening the housing crisis in Australia. What's your take on this? Because this is something which is considered too PC to be spoken about.
Yeah. Look, firstly, migration has been wonderful for Australia, but within limitations.
Yep.
Right now, since... the early about 2003, we were averaging something like about 80,000 net migration rate, for many years. And then in about the early 2000s, that got blown out to the 200,000 or something net migration rate. Okay.
Yeah.
In the last 12 months, there were 737,000 new migrants came to this country. 737,000. It netted out around about 520,000. So we had an extra 520,000 new migrants additional that came to this country. And, of course, we did this in the middle of a housing crisis.
Yep.
So we never had the housing for them to start with. We can't build that number of houses in the country. And so what happens? The old rules of supply and demand, and you've got all these restrictions about opening up new land releases. The prices of housing went up. The prices of rents went up. That pushed inflation up, which then let the Reserve Bank, push up the mortgage rates, which pushed up again the cost of living for everyone. Hmm. So what we've seen the economy, people say, the Australian economy's grown every single year, for the last 30 years. Well, yes, it has, only because we've done that through high rates of migration. If we want to keep growing the economy, we can annex the South Island of New Zealand and then the island of Bali and part of Papua New Guinea. That will keep growing your economy. But what it would do, it makes what the real measurement of whether you're going forwards or backwards is GDP per capita. At the moment, as a country, we are going backwards in GDP per capita. In fact, OECD statistics had real disposable income. We had a 6% decline last year in real disposable income, which was the worst performing nation in the OECD. So you say, Australia, the lucky country, last with the policies of the Labor and Liberal Party, we were the worst performing country in the OECD with our incomes going backwards. Because you're bringing in huge numbers of migrants into the country that you don't have the housing for. But so, yes, on the outside, it looks, isn't this wonderful, overall GDP is going up, but everyone is becoming poorer. The average rents here for a house in Sydney, the average rent for a house in Sydney is over $1,000 Australian a week. The average rent for a two-bedroom unit in Sydney is now $717 Australian for a two-bedroom unit. That is up over 30% in the last 18 months since the Albanese government has taken power. And that's all these people that went, you know, people that rented generally more likely to be Labor voters. And we've all gone and voted Labor at the last election. Oh, you know, Labor's won. Yes, isn't this fantastic? I've seen their rents put up 30% because of the policies of the Labor Party pushing all these migrants in. Tell everyone, don't get sick if you're in Australia at the moment, because our public hospitals are bursting at the seams. Right? If you go to a public hospital, you know, you'll be queued up out the door. If you ring an ambulance, you know, good luck. You know, we've had so many cases that ambulances haven't turned up and people have died. Good luck trying to get an ambulance, because if you've got an extra 700,000 people in the country, they all need these services. We haven't been providing them additionally. It is destructive to the nation. It is destructive to the living standards of this country. And, you know, we really need to be able to call this out. And it's been a difficult environment, because as soon as you say we should cut back migration, they go, oh, racist. Yeah. You're a terrible racist. You know, hang on. Yeah. If you don't want to cut back on migration, tell me what level of migration do you think is acceptable?
Well,
where do you want to
put the cap?
Right? Exhibit number two. You go one person
over that cap. Exhibit number two is New Zealand, and there's plenty of other exhibits around the world where unfettered migration seems to be happening. And, you know, we have family in the States, both of us, and it appears no one's willing to tackle it. You know, wouldn't it be smarter if the people felt comfortable in their own country to stay there and make a life for themselves, if they could have the right institutions to allow that to happen? In fact, we interviewed a lady just last week, actually, Craig, called Ileana Johnson Paul, and she had written where she lives in Washington, D.C., just on the outskirts, actually. Mm-hmm. Her street has her flag on a pole, the American flag, but the other neighbors have the country of their origins flag flying. Now, that is a sad state of affairs, and I hope it's not happening in Australia, because, by God, if I see it happening in New Zealand, I would be aghast. So that's where we are.
Just talk about the flag. We had our Australia Day celebrations here, 26th of January, right? And everyone gets out, and it's a day of – always been a day of celebration, right? There are now on Australia Day these anti-Australia Day people that get out and celebrate. The big Woolworths supermarkets here refuse to stock Australia Day merchandise.
Yeah.
So you think it was a great day, you know, it's always like throw a bit of lamb on the barbecue and get in, have a party and celebrate with friends and celebrate the nation and, you know, put the flag out the front. That's how it always been. But now you had the biggest supermarket in the country refusing to sell anything to do with Australia Day. And we had and here's the thing. On every social media page of the Labor Party politicians, I couldn't find one of them that put up an Australian flag in the background.
Not one of them was
prepared to stand up in front of the flag of their own country on their own national day and say, I'm proud of this country.
We see the same thing here. We see politicians, Liberal politicians, wishing everyone, you know, right from Diwali, which is Indian festival, to the Chinese Lunar New Year, to everything.
Which is nothing wrong with that.
There's nothing wrong with that. But
you want to celebrate your own day.
Exactly. And you see them dressed in costume. I saw them on the Chinese New Year dressed in, I don't even know what the costumes are called, but they were dressed for the, you know, part. And it seems to me, because I can look back as a migrant who came here 15 years ago, I can look back and say that in India, no politician would be paying homage to another country's New Year or their celebration or anything. And yet here is the West, you know, liberal Western democracies bending over backwards. What Don was speaking about, this lady we had on, Ileana, so she had left Romania under Ceausescu. She knows communism. And that's why she was aghast that we have people who come to the US And they straight away start talking about how racist the country is. Then her, this thing was, why are you here? That's of course a thing. I see it among the diaspora, the Indian Southeast Asian diaspora here. They've been here for a while, but most of them don't understand or don't go there. They don't understand the fact that farming is being ruined right now. They come into, you know, townie jobs, for lack of a better word, and they have no real understanding or appreciation of what's going through the rest of the country because it's a job. Most people today, unlike someone, say, escaping Fidel Castro's regime, they've come here for the economic part of it, the economic migrants. And that's all they are focused on. And that's something that worries me, that they don't have a real appreciation of the country they've adopted or what's really going on. The healthcare, it is third world now. Marora last year when she broke her arm, 2 days waiting in the emergency room in Invercargill. We did come home each night, came home back to the farm, 80 kilometers, drove back. But 48 hours for a seven-year-old to see her, to see a surgeon. Can't fault them once we got to them 48 hours later. But that's what it's coming to. And I was wondering, I said, if I was in Delhi, no problem. Just go to a surgeon, get her seen ASAP. But that's what it's come to. So where is the end to this? But the other thing that I'm seeing, and since you're at Sydney, because now you have mass migration, it is an excuse to run roughshod over the existing planning laws, isn't it? Buildings and everything, and just completely destroy the whole place, the character of the place.
You're right. That's the other thing. You've now got here in Sydney, and I've got, you know, the local councils are now being forced to double and triple the density.
Yeah.
So where you find you may have had one street with 20 houses in it, right? You've now got that one street with sort of 20 apartment blocks of 10 people, of 10 units in there.
Yeah.
So you're having the traditional Australian, the idea that you'd have some kids and they have your own backyard to run and play and have a game of cricket and kick the footy around is a thing of the past. All these new developments are going up. These massive high-rise developments all over the place, and even like you travel an hour plus out of the city, away from the city, and the developments they're cutting up are these tiny little blocks of 300 square meters that have no backyard on. They look like terrace houses you would see in inner city, and they're building these like an hour away from the city. It is the traffic. There's an expressway that goes from the southwest of Sydney into the city. At 5 a.m. in the morning, it is bumper bar to bumper bar.
Wow.
Because people trying to get people living on the outskirts of the city because of the rents are so high and traveling every day into the city. It is really a major deterioration in the standard of living and the quality of life in this country. And the problem is it does the major political groups, in Australia, it's the factions that run both the Labor and Liberal Party. I mean, there's a few groups of people that think this is fantastic. They love the idea of a great big Australia. It means that their business organisation can increase their sales, have a greater increases in sales, therefore greater increases in profitability. For the property developers, love it. It's more continual upsurge in price, and continual development of units. But for the average citizen, it is detrimental and is making our standard of living decline. And we've got to be able to at least debate these things and debate the level of migration that we can have without the other side pointing the finger and going racist, and not wanting to have the debate.
Completely agree. And if you are talking of a two-bedroom unit costing something like $800 on an average, my automatic, as a woman, I think I'm not going to have more than one child. That is not the place. I have two children, and I wouldn't. And I think that would automatically lead to a decline in the birth rate, wouldn't it? Sure. New Zealand has
the lowest. And then you have to have more migration rates to catch up.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy there.
And what it also does, my real concern about what it's doing is that for many years we had one of our greatest prime ministers, Prime Minister Menzies, and he, one of his goals in the 50s and after the Second World War, one of his goals was to make sure that he increased the home ownership rates of Australia. That was the goal, to get it up. We got up to like 80% of people would own their own homes. That is now going backwards. We're now going backwards. Now we have a whole generation of young Australians that look at the price of property in the major capital cities and they just say, I've got no hope of affording that. Like you come to Sydney today and try and find something you could buy under $1 million Australian. You'd be lucky to find something. You'd be lucky to get a dog box somewhere for $900,000. So if you're thinking, oh, I can buy something very, very average for $1 million, right? You've got to have $200,000 deposit and then borrow $800,000. Now, yes, that may be, if you can afford it, it may be a reasonable investment. But the problem is kids today, young working couples, they can't, unless they've got some inheritance, they put together $200,000 deposit and then to finance an $800,000 mortgage. And then what happens if you want to have the mother, goes off and decides she wants to have a couple of kids and take time off work? It is destroying the fabric of our society. And when you take away the dream of home ownership from a young generation, you change the culture of the country. Right? Instead of people saying, I've got to work hard, I've got to save, I've got to build this house up. It's my place. It's my place on the earth. They become house proud. They maintain the lawns and the gardens and the backyards and invite friends over for the backyard. Yeah. If you take away that, people say, well, stuff it. Why should I bother working hard? It doesn't matter how hard I work, I'm still never going to be able to afford a place. Let me just go out on the weekend and let's get on the drink, let's get on the party drugs, and have a good time. And we've got a superannuation policy and the government will look after me. I don't have to worry about that. You really change the values of the society for the worst. And unfortunately, that is the direction that we are heading.
Yeah, I think that's right, Craig. And so it just shows you that Jasper, would it be fair to say we're not facing that in New Zealand either? We're not sort of facing the demand for infrastructure. You talk about hospitals, schools, roads. It doesn't matter where you look, we are not keeping up with this pressure to allow more people into the country. It's almost like it's unfettered. And of course, if you are a property speculator, if you are a builder, or you are a conveyancing legal firm or something, it's a panacea for you.
That's right.
It's a panacea. But you're not thinking, self-interest is driving lots of people. So look, great, we've had that discussion. New Zealand, by the way, Craig, I remember when we had you on a year ago, you talked about that 500,000 net migration. We actually were told at that time we would have about 70,000. 69,000 was the number we were going to have. Guess where we ended up?
I've seen the numbers are off the charts. There seems to be some globalist agenda. It's the same in Canada.
Yep.
It's the same in the UK. It's the same in the USA, but they're just flying illegally across the border there. It seems to be sort of almost like someone in Klaus's operation, the World Economic Forum, US, okay, these are the nations that will have uncontrolled migration and everyone's following suit.
Yeah, of course, we're crazy even talking about it, aren't we? If we mention Klaus's name, we're labelled the crazy, crazy Klaus followers or opposers. Interestingly, we should talk about a couple of other things. Like the reckless renewable rallies. Have you had anything? Have you been close to that? The Australian farmers sort of rallying against the infrastructure built across their land.
Yeah, it's funny. We had a rally in Canberra a couple of weeks ago. They called it the Reckless Renewables Rally. And I said, guys, I said, I was here 12 years ago at a similar rally, campaigning against almost the same thing. But look, we used to enjoy the cheapest electricity in the world here in Australia. We have that beautiful black coal seam that runs down our eastern seaboard. We've got the brown coal deposits in Victoria. That gave us the cheapest electricity in the world, right? And when you've got the cheapest electricity in the world, you can build aluminium smelters, you can create all these other jobs, and you can pay the workers in those jobs a premium that they can't get elsewhere. And you underwrite the economy, you create wealth, you build prosperity. That's what we had. And then we decide, no, we've got to stop, we've got to stop bad weather. We've got to wind this back. We've got to reduce our carbon dioxide emissions. China doesn't have to do it, right? But Australia does. So we had this mad drive for policies, all driven by subsidies. to import solar panels from China and wind turbines. And recently it's gotten out of control with the new Labor government is completely out of control. A minister here called Chris Bowen, who we call Blackout Bowen, because his policies are going to lead to blackouts in this country. Wanting to close down our coal-fired power stations and build these solar panel farms and these wind farms out in the countryside on farmland, either on farmland or on areas where you have to cut down thousands of acres of beautiful forest, prime koala habitat, and destroy all the native wildlife to protect the environment. You know, we've got to cut down thousands of acres and we've got to get out and kill all these koalas to save the environment. Yeah? It is madness. And then because they are located so far off the grid, you've got the cost of something. I said there was a number of a trillion Australian dollars. So that's a thousand billion. What's that? That's a million millions. Is that right? There's so many noughts. It doesn't matter. So a trillion Australian dollars, $1,000 billion to build these transmission lines, these new transmission lines, which we wouldn't need if we just replaced our existing coal, a couple of existing coal-fired power stations. And these are going through. So the farmers are raising concerns about it. I'll give you an example. In Victoria alone, a government report has said you need 70% of the existing agricultural land in Victoria to hand over to build solar and wind farms to reach net zero. 70% of the agricultural land, and this is a government report, and Victoria is well known for its magnificent agriculture, 70% of that land is going to be handed over to build these renewable things, right, if they're going to get to net zero. That is the insanity.
It is insane. Of course, 70% of the land area that's in production now being taken out of production would just be stupid. And, of course, they know it's stupid, but they are pushing ahead with their agenda to the point where they get at least part the way. And, of course, the people that are promoting these things are getting, I don't know how they're getting paid back, because I'd assume all the consumers of Australia are going to, the electricity consumers will be paying the bill.
Unfortunately, we've had, 25 years or longer, 30 years of brainwashing of an entire generation of kids in school that have been taught that carbon dioxide is this black, dark, evil substance that is going to kill us all and stop the trees from growing. I saw there was one school protest and the kids got the sign up, let the trees breathe. Right? Hang on. The trees love the carbon dioxide, right? We've got, if you look at the data from around the world, we've got global greening going on. There's more trees and greener on the planet today, a substantial amount more than when I left high school.
Yep.
And these kids are being told all the trees are going to be killed because of this dreadful carbon dioxide. So,
it's a common story on the show.
How you unbrainwash a couple of, so you've got the brainwashed teachers teaching the brain, that were brainwashed at school, now teach you brainwashing the kids. How you undo this? It's not easy.
No.
And for a politician, it's we've got all these wonderful teals. So noble people that they're there to fight for climate change, and they're going to give us better weather, and they are so wonderful and nice people. In there,
while living a comfortable life in the suburbs.
That's right. You find them all. They're all in places. Five to ten, they'd be living in $5 million plus houses, right?
Yes.
With huge multiple portfolios of rental properties. Remember, if you're living in the northern part of Sydney, and you own property, you've had an increase in your wealth with these housing prices of over $1 million in the last couple of years. But not creating any new businesses or creating wealth or coming up with a new way to create a new product or a new service or do something better. Just through the capital appreciation of your house driven by migration, you've made $1 million, millions of dollars. So you now think, now I'm so noble and wonderful. We've got to stop, I've got to stop climate change. And the media sucks up to these people, and all they are doing is destroying the wealth of our country, and it is, as I said, a wealth transfer from this country to the communist Chinese. It hands the communist Chinese an economic, political and military advantage over us. And yet this is supposedly the wonderful thing that we need to do.
Yeah, the climate change, this show's called Greenwashed, and we've decided that effectively climate change policies are pretty much, we can't get away from them no matter where we look. It's all about climate that's taking us apart. So we're talking about this every week virtually, Craig, and it's a slow process to get people to
the reality of life is that this is going to unwind because people will finally wake up and see how destructive it is.
Mm.
The only question is how many good people have we got? They're going to stand there and fight the fight, and how can we limit the damage until enough people can wake up? That's the question that we've got. Yeah. It's just the matter. We see it unraveling already in Europe. You see with what's happened to the German economy, the cost of energy over in Europe. You can see the so-called electric car revolution, collapsing in a heap. This fantasy of green hydrogen, like a complete and utter pipe dream. It is slowly collapsing. It is slowly waking up. As I said, the referendum we had gives me confidence that when you can debate these issues, when you can put the data and facts on the table, you're not going to win every people. There's many that are just their minds are shut like steel traps. It wouldn't matter what evidence that you put in front of them. But all the data, no matter what data. The guy said, we have a climate emergency. I said, okay, give me one indicator that shows we have a climate emergency. You go through it. If you look at the number of deaths from climate disasters is at historic lows and continues to decline. It's down like 90+% over the last 100 years. The actual insurance data shows a decline in the economic losses from climate disasters. The actual number of climate disasters this century is not increasing, it's declining. Pacific Islands, you said these Pacific Islands are growing, they are not shrinking. And I was at Tuvalu, so many extra hectares because of the way, the accretion is greater than the erosion of these islands. We've got record crop yields because of the extra CO2. Crop yields that, continue to break new records. We've got global greening going on. And if it is slightly warmer, that's good because we know more people die from the cold weather than they do the hot.
Yeah.
100%. So
I can't find one parameter that shows things are getting worse, let alone that there's this disaster. And if you look through Australia's long climate records, it was clearly much hotter back in the 30s, late 30s than it is today. We were told we'd have this glow, the drought was never going to end. Our dams were never going to fill again. Warragamba Dam here, big Warragamba Dam in Sydney has been, it's almost at 100% at the moment. It's been overflowed so many times. So we're in a period of strong rainfall. You look through Australia's records, we have these, the land of drought and flooding rates. The science and the data is all on what you want to call ourselves skeptics. It's all on our side.
It's all on our side. I mean, does Tim Flannery have any conscience, do you know? Does he have any conscience for the things he used to say?
And this is where it becomes red. Flannery told everyone, basically, it was never going to rain again. And his famous quote was, even the rains that fall will not fill the dams.
Yeah.
So what happened? We had every state government here run around and spend billions of dollars building desalination plants.
Right?
Yeah. So the famous one here in Sydney and Kurnell, right? When they started to build it, they had to build it, bring in the bilge pumps to pump out the water that had come from all the rain to build the desalination plant. And that sits there completely and utterly useless, right? And in the meantime, we're not increasing the size of our dams. Yeah, we bring all these people in. And if we did have when the next drought comes, for the cost we spend on these desalination plants, it would be cheaper to air freight in Perrier water from France to get us through than it would to turn these desalination plants on and run them.
It is diabolical what you're facing, but yet if you go back, this thing has to unravel. I'm looking at the COVID narrative now, Craig, and much of what we were told is all unraveling. You have, commissions going on, Royal Commissions of Inquiry and so on. Suddenly, everything they said, and you have politicians now trying to excuse themselves, saying they got bad medical advice. Medical doctors say, they got bad modeling advice, and the whole damn charade continues. I was reading something to my kids over the weekend, and this is the librarian of Fort Switch. And, at the end of it, my kids are pretty young. And my son said, oh, the Germans were, you know, Nazis were really bad people or something. He's just six. I said, no, actually, no, mate. It's not. I said, it's more than that. He said, what? I said, the others who said nothing. And no one, yes. And he says, what do you mean? I said, for bringing it down to his level, I said, bad things happen when good people do correct. Nothing. And correct. That is something I don't ever want to be accused of. You definitely will never be accused of. You've all been talking about this endlessly on a loop, just so that there's never a time that one of these people in power who are pushing these crazy decisions can say, they didn't know that. They didn't know better. They did. They were bloody well told hundreds of thousands of times, aren't they, Don?
They were. They
exactly right
were.
Now.
Mm-hmm.
These politicians are now saying, oh, you know, we got the wrong advice, right? You don't need advice to know that to force someone to undergo a medical intervention against their will is improper. That is written. That is something that's written. That came out, you know, when we went through the Second World War, you know, the horrors of the Second World War, the Nuremberg trials. We wrote that into the, you know, in the Nuremberg Code, that you can't force someone to undergo an experimental medical intervention. We wrote it in the code. We've got the Universal Declaration of Bioethics and Human Rights, Article 6.1. It says you cannot force someone to undergo a medical intervention, whether it's experimental or not, and use coercion or prejudice and disadvantage. They are principles. They are like principles that are carved in stone. These principles should be carved in stone at the entrances of every parliament house. And we've got these possible purposes. We panicked and I thought it was a magic, you know, a magic juice or a magic potion sort of thing. And, you guys all had the chance to know you were doing, you should have known from the start you were doing the wrong thing, irrespective if it was, even if it was a magic potion, you should have known. And you should have been able to have a fair debate. You silenced the debate. You went through policies of censorship, as where all the doctors that were trying to scream out and saying, stop, 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 this is madness, all those doctors were censored. They were taken off social media. They were thrown out of their jobs. They were persecuted and prevented from being doctors. We got doctors here that are still have been thrown out because they decided to use their skill in the art of medicine and prescribe their patients ivermectin because of the studies and the research they looked at. They thought that could help their patients save their lives. And these people were thrown out of their jobs and they are still out of work today from things 3 years ago.
So we need to draw this to a conclusion, but this is very, very salutary. The warnings are, high stakes. What we're running in a COVID inquiry very soon. We're trying to get some input into the terms of reference for it a bit, the scope a bit wider. What would you be your, say, four key things a COVID inquiry would cover?
He's like, firstly, I wouldn't have one COVID inquiry. I'd have multiple because there are so many particular issues. Okay, one, we need to look at the patent system of medicine because that is where the whole issue comes about. If you're the big pharma, if you can patent a medicine and get that through the approval systems, you have a license. You basically have a license to print yourself rubies and gold. And then you've got the opposite hand. You've got the thing of the basically anti-competitive conduct that you engage in to prevent off-label competition from off-patent medicines competing against you. What we saw now, I'd like to know a few things I'd like to look at. The war against hydroxychloroquine, there's that Sergisphere study that was published in The Lancet that said a hydroxychloroquine was bad and having a greater rate of death, that stopped a lot of the World Health Organization trials and went around the world in the media. The data was made up. Who was paying that guy? Who was financing that guy to make the data up? Right? I'd like to get those people from Oxford that did that hydroxychloroquine study that overdosed the patients, that used toxic levels of overdose, that gave six times the recommended dose of hydroxychloroquine and gave it to them late and excluded zinc and excluded the antibiotic. I'd like to get them in the stand and have a good barrister cross-examine them and tear them apart to find out, you know, how the bloody hell did you give sick old people or sick people this toxic dose? And in that study, that Oxford study, they killed over 1,000 people. Oh, the God. Study that they ran to demonize hydroxychloroquine, 25% of the people that signed up to that study died. Whoa. Just think of it. They signed 4,000 people up, and within 28 days, 1,000 people were dead. Half of them they gave nothing to and let them sit there and die. And the other half, they knew that hydroxychloroquine could work with zinc, but they waited until late, and then they gave them a toxic overdose, and then they left out the zinc. They're the people I'd like to get behind the stand. I want to get the TGA in the stand. I want to explain to the here in Australia, why did you approve, how is it possible that you in Australia approved the Moderna injections for 12-year-old children in Australia when that drug, that that injectable was made in the USA, but even the US CDC and the US regulators said, hang on a minute, we're not 100% sure this is safe for kids. So we're not going to approve it for injections in 12-year-olds. In Europe, they said no. But here in Australia, they said, yeah, it's okay to shoot this up in the arms of 12-year-old kids. That was Moderna. And just coincidentally, at the same time, the federal government is all entering into a contract with Moderna to build an mRNA vaccine production facility as a joint venture in Melbourne. Just a coincidence, I suppose. How did you continue to deploy remdesivir when all the studies showed it was so dangerous and it was killing people? Why did you continue to allow remdesivir to go when at the same time you were blocking ivermectin? Why did you get in? Why did you interfere in the doctor-patient relationship with ivermectin? Now, you can argue on hydroxychloroquine, oh, yes, yes, we're worried about the shortage of the drugs. A BS, right? Mr. Clive Palmer bought 30 million doses for every Australian of hydroxychloroquine, which was sitting in the government stockpile. And you say, oh, no, they criminalised it in Queensland.
Mm.
These people need to be in the dock. And we need to have the best, most aggressive barristers questioning them about trying to explain their activities. That's what we need. But unfortunately, I don't think, we're not going to get it here in Australia. We're going to have this Mickey Mouse inquiry that will do absolutely nothing, that will not question these people. And I think we'll find the same. Even if we did have a Royal Commission, they would make the terms of references so weak and so watered down, and they'd have, like, what is effectively the prosecution so weak that, you know, you're not going to get anything. We need full-blown Royal Commission's investigative powers with the right people in there to run them basically as prosecutions, right, just like they did in Nuremberg, to run those prosecutions against these people that made all these decisions.
Yep. So, look, listeners, that's what we're up against, really. Craig has sort of told you his view on what needs to happen in Australia. And, of course, we're very concerned that the New Zealand inquiry won't be have a wide enough scope either. And I'm not sure whether we can influence it to the level we need to, Jaspery, but certainly RCR is trying its best to get people and Voices for Freedom, get people interested.
Just on that, you want to be asking Jacinta Ardern, who told you that it was safe and effective? She was out there like politicians in Australia, oh, yeah, this is safe and effective. You know, when she said, oh, if you take the vaccine, you won't catch COVID. Right? when the data, the best data and the earliest data came out of Israel.
Yep.
So in early 2021, Israel had set up, they called themselves the Pfizer experiment. They had set up these great websites. They thought it was going to work. So they set these great websites up in age category, vaccinated and unvaccinated, who was in hospital, who wasn't, right? And that data, you could tell from that data in early 2021 that the vaccines were having no effect whatsoever at stopping COVID, stopping the spread. You could see whatever percentage of the population was. So let's say, for example, it might have been 1,000 people in the 50 to 60-year-old age group had COVID.
Yeah.
80% were unvaccinated and 20% were vaccinated, and it was the same ratios, for the vaccine as it was for the people having COVID. And so it was consistent through all the age group brackets. So you can see the data, this idea, we didn't know.
The data had all our politicians, I think, gunning for the Pfizer salesman, saleswoman, salesperson of the year, if I'm really PC here. But listeners, if you are on here right now, you're listening to Craig Kelly from Australia, and this is yet another call out to anyone who has got the time and inclination, please submit to the New Zealand Royal Commission on COVID inquiry that closes on the 24th of March. Let them know your views in no uncertain terms about the nonsense you went through.
And so, look, that's a good point to perhaps wrap this up. We've had an hour almost of Craig's time, and we're very, very grateful for it. I mean, we started off a bit lighthearted about his jump into the One Nation Party, and we wish him all the best for that. You've got a massive task trying to build a constituency around 150 candidates, 151 actually. And, you know, I dare say, I think we're on the same side of politics, whether you call, I think I'm a liberal conservative or a classic, well, whatever they call them, you can call whatever it is. We've got fairness and common sense and reasonableness amongst us all. It's hard to believe the attention that people like you get. Clearly, you're making a statement that is vital. And long may you keep doing it, is what I say, because we need you, and we need Malcolm Roberts and Pauline and others to really stand tall.
We've got some good people there. Malcolm Roberts, a champion, someone that someone that goes into the data. This is, I know we're over time, but thank you much. I remember a case. There was early on in 2020. I think it was the end of 2020. There was a couple of peer reviewed studies published. On the use of betadine, as betadine gargles, right? And they showed they were remarkably effective, right? And I put on my social media, this looks good news, this is an interesting study, looks as though betadine's effective against COVID, right? And I was quoting directly from the peer-reviewed study, right? And I was torn apart in the media, ha, 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 what an idiot. He thinks betadine works against COVID. What a fool he must be, right? Without any of them having a look and reading the underlying scientific paper. And one of them said, yeah, but it's from Bangladesh. Like, what would they know? doctor, they said, I hit the doctor behind and said, he's a plastic surgeon. We tracked the bloke down. It turns out he was educated in the UK. He was Bangladeshi, educated in the UK, came top of his class, he's in all his medical classes, right? And the work of plastic surgery he did was with kids that were burnt. So you imagine like the decency of the humanity of that man. But they could have had a successful career living in the UK, but went back to his homeland in Bangladesh to help children that had been disfigured by being burnt in open fires that they have there, right? And he was being rubbished here in Australia as an idiot, a plastic surgeon trying to push betadine. This is the nonsense that we're up with, where people wouldn't sit down and you couldn't get a fair debate against these people. That's what we've got to get back to. Programs like yours are important. Because it gives us a chance in a longer form to talk about the data, to talk about the evidence, to talk about the science, because that's what our opponents don't want to do. They want to work on hysteria and emotion and avoid a factual debate.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And look, brave people like you and Malcolm Roberts and others around you, we've just got to have them. And, you know, we, Jaspreet and I are probably looking for someone in New Zealand to fill that void, but...
We keep seem to be looking over the ditch, Craig. But thank you so much for your time today.
There must be someone there as crazy as I am.
We keep hoping. But
amongst all those good hard-headed rugby forward sort of thing, there must be someone there someone there. Surely you can dig out from somewhere.
No, they've been got at. They've been got at by the media. You know, 30 years, as you say, 25, 30 years of indoctrination has got into people's minds, and it's very hard to get them to stand up and say, oh, that isn't right. So, hey, look, we'll get you back, Craig. Man, this has been far, far longer than we anticipated. So thanks for your time. Great to have you back.
I hope when we come back, we can celebrate another great Australian win over New Zealand. I know we gave you blokes a towel up in the 2020s the other day, and pretty good in the first test.
Time to cut them off. Yes, Craig, time to cut them off.
Thanks, Craig. Catch you another
Thanks
time.
Thanks a lot. Okay. Cheers, bye-bye. Guys.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom. Simply visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.